Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here with another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today's going to be a little bit different. Usually we talk protein, carbs, fat. We talk paleo. We may diverge into a little bit of that stuff. But today we're going to touch on a topic that is really just near and dear to my heart, which is this idea of sustainability as it relates to paleo, and in particular, this concept of soil restoration, carbon sequestration. And I have two phenomenal guests on the show today, Russ Konser and Peter Bick. Guys, can you please give a little bit of each of your background? Peter, maybe we'll start with you, and then we'll jump right into the meat of the show.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you for having us on. It's a real honor. My name is Peter Bick, and I am a filmmaker. I made a movie called Carbon Nation, which has been out for a few years. Our tagline is a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. And I've now, because I've focused on climate, I've realized through a lot of amazing work by a lot of amazing people that the soil is a huge, huge store of carbon, and that's where I'm focused on. We just made a new movie called Soil Carbon Cowboys. And that is about ranchers doing regenerative grazing, adaptive grazing, and having phenomenal results. And we're at the very, very beginning of trying to figure out scientifically what's going on.
Awesome. Russ, give us some of your background.
Sure. Well, I'm kind of probably odd in here. I'm a mechanical engineer by training. I just retired from a 30-year career at a large oil and gas company. Where early in my life, my day job was counting carbon in the soil. And I happened to be at TED 2 years ago when this guy, Alan Savory, gave a talk on how changing how we graze animals might put carbon in the soil. I said, well, if that's true, I can go measure that. And then the funny thing was here, the following week after that TED conference, I was giving a talk on innovation at a place called the Urban Land Institute. And a guy came up to me and said, you need to meet my friend Peter Bick. Because you guys think the same. And so Peter and I got on the horn, and I thought we were just going to have a general conversation about sustainable energy innovation. And Peter says, have you heard about soil carbon? And so Peter and I have been working on this now for a little over a year. And quite some energy. We're very excited about the subject.
You know, for me, so you know, clearly I came into all this stuff with kind of a medical research kind of orientation, looking at this paleo diet concept and the evolutionary biology behind, you know, how theoretically maybe humans adapted as hunter-gatherers over a long period of time and possibly emulating certain characteristics of that ancestral life way might have some benefit for the ailments that afflict us today, you know, changes in circadian rhythm, changes in gut biome, changes in the way that we socialize with one another. And I feel like we've had quite a lot of success with that. And, you know, as far back, I want to say 2000, 2001, I had in the back of my head that there was probably a sustainability story that was similar to what I was envisioning on this kind of evolutionary medicine applied to humans story. But I had absolutely no data to support it. It was a guess. And I think maybe some of it was trying to, pacify my kind of moral misgivings with getting back in and eating animal products because I'd been vegan for a time and suffered a lot of health problems as a consequence. But As things have motored along and we've seen work from Polyface Farms and from Alan Savory, it really looks like this, you know, applying kind of evolutionary medicine to soils and to sustainable ecosystems that we interface with, we might actually have something to this. But, you know, the main story that is portrayed in the media and just kind of it's just this gestalt kind of thing for most folks is that Planet of the Vegans is the only way that we're going to feed everybody. But may in fact be the quickest route to scuttling our whole operation that you could imagine. Could you guys maybe comment on that a little bit? I mean, we're really like nutcases proposing that grazing animals could be the solution to not just food production, but reversing, you know, sequestering carbon, reversing soil erosion, and things like that.
Sure. Why don't I start and then throw it to Peter? Because Rob, I kind of came in through a similar but slightly different door. I found my way into evolutionary health stuff when dealing with some health problems with my dad. And it indeed, you know, kind of changed the way I was eating. But then I was like, gosh, is this sustainable, right? Can we feed the planet, you know, with organic produce and grass-fed beef? And so really had that as a dilemma in my own mind as well. And then I think that's what actually perked up my ears the most when I first heard Alan's TED Talk was, hold on a minute. I mean, there's a chance that this thing that's good for my health might actually be good for the planet if it's done differently. And that certainly made me curious in that. And then for what it's worth, as I've gotten into it, you know, it's not only kind of similar to, it's very coupled with the health system. So, for example, you know, you mentioned, Rob, there, the microbiome and gut stuff. I think the magic to this thing is going to come down to, at the end of the day, the healthy microbiome in the soil. The soil is kind of the intestinal tract of the earth. It's the interface between the external environment and the solid environment. It's where all life happens. It's where photosynthetic energy is captured in plants and fed to microbes. When they're healthy, they grow and sequester carbon. And when they don't, they respire and give it off. And so these things fit. And even some of the kind of the analogous principles are the same. So things I've certainly heard a lot on your a podcast of, you know, lift heavy things, heavy exercise. I mean, really kind of holistic grazing or adaptive high density grazing is short duration grazing, as we call it, is one of these things. It's kind of like the equivalent of high intensity interval training for the land. That is, the cattle come in and do something quickly and then they get off and you have a long rest period. And so I think what we're learning is a lot of these principles that nature works by applies to the you know, inside the human body, but also to the broader environment. And once we figure out how to couple those things, then environment and health can get together, can get better at the same time.
It's a bit fractal in nature, and maybe if we could learn something in one place, we might not need to relearn it elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely true. Peter?
Yeah, the first question I asked Russ was, has he ever heard of grass-finished beef? And he said, yeah, I eat it for my health. And then I said, have you heard of Alan Savory and his work? Yes. And I said, have you considered the carbon implications of this? And he goes, well, started to, but what do you got? And so not only do we think that the human gut's important and the soil biome is important, but the cow gut is also another biome. I think it's these three things that are really suited to a really good dance together when we let them.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, Russ was a very innovative guy at a very big company, is Shell Oil. And I knew that Shell was basically putting a lot of interest in carbon capture and sequestration. That's my entry point for this whole conversation. And so when I talked to Russ, I said, what if there were enough ranchers doing these new techniques? Because there's very few of them doing it right now. And the anecdotal evidence is pretty amazing, but we need a lot more science, and we can talk about our whole science approach. But what if enough ranchers were getting enough carbon into the soil? Wouldn't that be a positive for the world, especially with a fossil fuel company? And that's really what started our conversation. And Shell has given us a grant to look at, you know, what's that business look like? What do those businesses look like? And we've had an enormously, I mean, I'll just speak for myself. I've had an amazing time working with the people that we've collaborated with at that company. And we've come up with some pretty cool stuff on the business front. And we're early days in opening up the ideas that we're talking about to the whole company. But it's been an amazing experience. And the idea is, if you get enough ranchers to do adaptive grazing, they start sequestering enough carbon, you start really affecting the planet in a very, very positive way. And it's you know, Russ, I think you should talk about this. This is the thing where it's almost like borrowing the carbon rather than taking the carbon and putting it up in the atmosphere. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, for what it's worth, Rob, the thing that really hit me early on when I went out looking for data, and it's very sketchy right now. One of the things Peter and I are working on very heavily with a team of leading scientists from around the country is to go out and do better science here, because what we have is fairly limited. But from the data that we have, the level of organic carbon concentration in soils where ranchers were practicing these new methods versus ranchers that weren't was kind of the pretty much exactly the same difference between what we call lean and rich source rocks in the oil and gas industry. Source rocks are the solid organic material that were laid down millions of years ago that got buried deep in the earth, and then they're cooked with time, temperature, and pressure, and that cooked oil and gas comes out and it floats up to the top where someone comes along with the drilling rig, pokes a hole in it, and sucks it out, sends it to a refinery, goes to your car, and then unfortunately goes into the air, the CO2 coming out of that. What we're basically proposing here with this is closing the loop on the fossil fuel industry. That is, that the levels of organic carbon that we're seeing in the soils being very comparable to the levels of organic carbon that were in the old soils, let's say from the time of the dinosaurs, it's almost like what we're doing is we've been borrowing carbon from yesterday's sunlight from millions of years ago, and now we're putting it back. So it's kind of a full circle sustainable business model. Again, one of those things that kind of just, well, duh, I guess if you work with nature, nature does what nature does, and nature photosynthesizes energy, stores energy in the form of hydrocarbons. That's what all life is. So we're just closing the loop here. That's all we're asking. We're not asking for any miracles. I think the miracles
other here, than the miracle of life. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice, Rob. Nice.
So guys, you know, clearly I'm bought in on this stuff. Like, it makes complete sense to me. Russ, when you first reached out to me, my assistant forwarded the email on. He's like, I almost put this in the spam box because clearly it's a joke, you know. And then we started talking, and I just about lost my mind. But let's look at the other side of this. Like, clearly grazing done improperly, row crops done improperly, et cetera, are very damaging to the environment, very damaging to the topsoil. What's going on in that process exactly? And then let's kind of compare and contrast for folks. You guys explained it already, but again, I think that people are so immersed in this one paradigm that grazing is bad. Like there's some programs now where if you have some kind of wetlands on some property that you own, you can get a really beefy tax break if you basically take that stuff off the grid forever. It can never be used for agriculture, can never be used for grazing, which the other side of this is that if land lays fallow and there isn't the interface between grazing animals and the plants and the microbiome, that's almost as bad as overgrazing. So there's a whole other flip side to this. But, you know, it's really woven into the psyche that, you know, grazing is bad. You know, it's incredibly damaging. But what we're proposing here is that actually it may be the thing that keeps all of this system tied together and functioning.
Well, I'd say before we go down too much of the road of what people are doing that's wrong or harmful, my take on all of that is I think there's a lot of really good people who aren't trying to be wrong or harmful. I think they're just trying to do their job and be farmers. And I wish more people were farmers. Was it 1% of Americans are farmers right now? I want 10% of Americans to be farmers. It's what these folks, these people on the cutting edge are doing right is the stuff that lets me sleep at night and wakes me up in the morning, all in a good way. The way they're basically taking their cattle and they're emulating the way herds moved across the prairies. So you have this high dense population of animals with hooves, and they're grazing, and they poo and they pee and they eat, and they know when to stop. They actually know when to stop eating the forage, and then the wolves come, chase them away, and that land rests for, it could rest for a year, 2 years. We're emulating that heavy hit and then that rest period. And a lot of our ranchers are finding out that if they have, they can have 800 head of cattle on, or the top guy in our world, Neil Dennis, He'll put 850 head of cattle in 1 acre, and he'll have them hit it for 2 hours. And then he'll move them on to the next acre. He's got 1,000 acres, and he'll let that first acre rest for 80 days. That's like his sweet spot up in Saskatchewan. And he's sequestering an enormous amount of carbon in his soil. There's a lot of questions of what kind of carbon that is, but the results are pretty amazing. He's making more money per acre. He's putting on weight on the animals a lot better. His animals are a lot healthier. Like, I have a lot of vegan friends, and I respect anyone who doesn't want to eat an animal. How could I ever say don't eat an animal, right? I just totally respect that. But I say to my vegan friends, you still want those animals walking around on the land that you're going to then grow the food you do want to eat, because it's turning on this whole biome in the soil. You know, carbon is the currency, and in the cattle and their hooves, they're turning on the seeds. It's this phenomenal thing that's happening. We have a rancher in Mississippi, Alan Williams, and those hooves of those cows on his ranch or his farm have stimulated seeds that have been laying dormant in his soil for 150 years.
Wow.
The seeds have been there. They just have basically said, screw you, I'm not growing in these conditions, you know, like a Hollywood starlet. And now they're growing like wild, and it's blown away the scientists that have gone down there. And so I want to talk about what's doing right, because I want to inspire people to come over this way. Folks, if you say folks are doing it wrong, they're going to get defensive and they're not going to want to change. We want people to be open-minded to look at this, because we want ranchers and farmers to make more money. We want them to make more money making healthier food, being healthier for themselves, being healthier for their animals. It's a really strong point that we've discovered on this.
Okay, I like that. I like that. Thank you. What this is one of the shows, every once in a while I get a show where the guests, I really wish I wasn't the interviewer. I wish I was just the guy listening and actually had somebody smart asking the questions, because I actually like to be engaged with what you guys are talking about. But, you know, what you just described there, it seems reminiscent of, you know, some of these species of trees and plants that require intermittent wildfire.
Right.
To perpetuate their life cycle.
The sequoias.
The sequoias, yeah. And, you know, so this is something, again, I think for folks to kind of anchor in here, you know, the evolutionarily or naturalistically, you know, created elements of these organisms, certain organisms, their life cycle is dependent on not just the possibly passing through the gastrointestinal tract of a ruminant, and then also potentially interacting with the hooves and the feces and the urine and all the rest of that stuff. That all may play critical elements in creating a really diverse environment. And when I was watching the Soil Carbon Cowboys movie, these guys were mentioning that at one time they would get out and spray enormous amounts of herbicide on a patch of land to knock down the clover, knock down the things that they were considering weeds. And most of these things happened to be these silly items that were nitrogen fixers. And so now these guys don't purchase a nitrogen fertilizer. They actually grow it. You know, they may buy some seed to prop those numbers up, but the things that they used to be trying to eradicate, they're now actively planting in these areas. And then the cows are benefiting, and these guys are making more money, and arguably the toxicant load going into our environment is dramatically reduced. Like, it just seems like a win all the way around. What do you guys feel like the largest, stumbling block to getting more acceptance with this is? You just mentioned, if someone's suggesting that maybe you try something different, then there's the implication that you're doing something wrong, and there's maybe some defensiveness there. Like, how do we, you educated this interviewer on how to ask that question better in the future, so that
right.
I don't make people defensive. And I logged that one, and I won't make that mistake again. But what else can we be doing to foster some discussion about this?
I think that the main thing is, you know, a lot of people don't know about this yet. It's just brand new. Although a lot of these techniques are as old as the hills, but the putting it all together is just really brand new, especially in a big industrial agricultural country like the United States. You know, get as few people growing as much food to feed as much people as possible. you know, why not get more people growing health, you know, really healthy food for as many people as possible? I just think there's a lot of people that don't know about this yet. So us being on your show is one of the most powerful things we can do, is because we can talk about this and make our films and do our science, which we should probably really talk about what we're getting ready to do, and just get to ranchers and farmers with ranchers and farmers doing the talking. And that's why the film can be so powerful. It's going to take time, but we also want to make it, we want to figure out ways that we can take that financial risk away from changing. And that's one of the business ideas that we're working on, is how do you take that financial risk of change away so that the rancher will be more attracted to the idea of changing?
Because a lot of these folks had, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the film, a lot of these folks are hanging on by their toenails currently because of some of the challenges of the current model. So suggesting that they do something different could clearly be pretty nerve-wracking.
Pretty nerve-wracking, and that's really important. The three cutting-edge folks in the movie all came to this through crisis. They didn't come to this, you know, just strolling down the path going, oh, I'm going to try this. They had to try something different because they were going out of business. And I think that's one of the things Gabe Brown says is, you know, don't wait till you're going out of business like me. Let me help you make that adjustment. And none of them are saying, you know, change 100% tonight. They're saying just try this on 40 acres. Just try these new techniques on 40 acres and see what you think. And, you know, we hear ranchers that are saying they don't want to be the one everyone else is laughing at or talking about on Saturday night. And then we're seeing a lot of young ranchers come to this, I think, with a more energy. And they kind of have to talk their dads or their uncles into it. And then they discover that there's really something powerful. One of the best stories I've got is there's a place called the Ranny Ranch in Corona, New Mexico. Families had the ranch since, I think, 1970, and the older generation died off in the early 2000s, and the next generation wanted to change the methods. But the ranch manager had been there the whole time, and he didn't want to change. He really didn't want to change. And they were in a heavy drought, and the owners said, well, we are changing, and we'd love it if you stayed because we love you. And within 3 years of the change, the guy who didn't want to change, the ranch manager, was blown away by already the differences he was seeing in his land that he knew so well. So it's really a question of just trying it, going places, exploring it, and seeing the successes. And really, I think with the biggest missing link, Rob, this is the biggest missing link, and Russ, you start, you know, I'll just hand it over to you on this one, is the science. There's just such a thin amount of science that there's so many, you know, so many scientists, land scientists, range scientists, who have been skeptical of this because they don't see any numbers that they can that they can rest on.
And I just have to interject there. It just sounds so eerily similar to this whole paleo diet scene, particularly with regards to autoimmune disease. Like, we had thousands and thousands of anecdotal, you know, stories. But again, you know, it's all still anecdote, and it's taken us almost 15 years to get to a point where now we have three or four really well done clinical trials with autoimmune disease related to a paleo diet. And the results are quite remarkable and very consistent with what we've seen on the anecdotal level. But it's one of those frustrating things, you know, where folks will say, where's the science? And it's like, well, help us get it. And then they're like, well, where's the science? And it's just this chicken and egg kind of thing. They're not willing to jump in at all until you get something. And it's hard to just prime the pump and get that going.
Yeah, and so we're working on that, you know, this is where I came in, and looking for data, I found that it was really, really sketchy, and almost none of it has been presented in peer-reviewed scientific literature yet. So there's great anecdotal stories, good raw data sets, but you can always question, was there some confounding variable, just like you said, Rob, is common in health things. The most important paper, And now the lead principal investigator of our scientific team that we formed to continue this work, is Dr. Richard Teague at Texas A&M University. And he wrote a paper in 2011 that looked at comparable ranches next to each other in the three separate counties in North Texas. Some that had been practicing these new methods, but some that have been practicing various forms of old methods or traditional methods, either with high density grazing or low density grazing. And he also captured some data from land that wasn't grazed at all. And in that paper, he was able to document some pretty substantial differences using rigorous statistical methods over large landscapes, so the equivalent of a good controlled trial. The difference was it wasn't kind of before and after. It was like, you know, ranchers who had already been practicing this stuff for a while, he was able to document. And what he saw was kind of the key magic number, and it's derived directly from numbers that are in his paper, amounts to a difference of 30 tons of carbon per hectare over about a 10-year period. And we approximate that by simply saying, okay, over about a 10-year period. So that's 3 tons of carbon per hectare per year, which turns into a really substantial number because there's 3.5 billion acres of grasslands on planet Earth.
Hectares.
I'm usually the guy that very cautious with the units. Yeah. But so that would say, and all kinds of caveats on, you know, how fast you could implement on 3.5 billion hectares, et cetera. But at least in terms of total scope, you'd say that, hey, that's 10 billion tons of carbon that could be taken up on the world's grasslands each year. And we don't know how long that might go, but at least 10, maybe 20, 30, maybe a little longer. And these turn out to be really substantial numbers. So now there's some key science that we don't know in terms of how the rest of the system balances itself. So if grasslands start taking up soil, the oceans will re-emit some land. So let's say only half of that comes out of the air and the other half comes out of the ocean and goes back into the air. So you've only drawn things down by half. But you, in the process, we're talking about making some pretty significant dents in atmospheric carbon. Now, what may be more important in that science were some of the other benefits besides carbon. So as you saw in the Soil Carbon Cowboys movie, you hear these anecdotal reports of people with better water retention. So they can weather droughts. So their fertility on their farm stays high when other people are drying up. So we've seen some of those variables, and now they're documented in that paper, almost twice the water infiltration, less soil erosion in that thing. And then the number that isn't usually paid attention to in that paper, but these best practice ranchers in that paper were actually carrying twice as many cattle per acre of land compared to the people that were practicing the traditional, most common methods over there. So, and this leads from the science into the business now, which is what we're seeing anecdotally, and we haven't documented rigorously with scientific studies yet, is the evidence that suggests that farmers who and ranchers who apply these novel methods can raise their productivity, they can cut their input costs, and the people that are clever entrepreneurs at this stage, but hopefully we can figure out how to scale that, have a product that commands a premium price in the market. So what's not to like from a business perspective? Those kind of opportunities don't come around long, where I can reduce my costs and increase my yield and sell my product for a higher margin in the first place. So we think that this science coupled with business are some real great opportunities where we can help this thing scale and scale quickly if we can kind of get through the education and experiential dimensions that Peter talked about.
Right. It makes some of my listeners do convulsions when I mention this stuff, but it always seems like the market-driven element ends up preceding the science, and the science then comes in after the market has kind of established what's really functioning, and then it revalidates what we've seen kind of winning out in the marketplace. So I find that really interesting. A lot of the work that I'm trying to do is create these systems where various like Savory Institute hubs or similar entities have a marketplace to sell this food to folks. And, currently it's a little bit scattered, but we've been talking with natural grocers. We've been talking with some other pretty big entities trying to get them in cahoots with the Savory Institute and the folks working with the Savory Institute so that we have these kind of decentralized production systems. Russ, this is maybe a question for you, but it definitely seems like consolidated distribution has a lot of advantages with regards to energy conservation and whatnot. My gut sense is that there's an advantage on decentralized production, centralization, and the distribution scheme. Do you agree with that, or do we need decentralization on both sides of this?
Rob, you're very insightful. Because it's exactly, Peter mentioned that we were off here looking at some of the business models that might be associated with helping unlock the potential in this space. And the reason I giggled a little bit there, because Peter knows that I think this particular issue of processing and distribution of grass-fed meat is one of the most significant business opportunities in the space. One of the things we've learned, Peter and I have been off around the country over the last 6 to 9 months, I guess we started last April, huh, Peter?
Yep.
And we've been talking to thought leaders, politicians, entrepreneurs, scientists. And one of the insights that came up here is that these small-scale grass-fed producers, they actually do okay. They're entrepreneurial, but typically what they do is they'll have their meat processed in a local mom-and-pop slaughterhouse, and they'll take it to a farmer's market, or they sell it online. But what we learned was that the cost of processing and handling for those people was something like 5 to 10 times more per pound of finished product than goes through one of these large CAFOs. So in terms of overall profitability, potential profit, that supply chain is broken. And so the suggestion was, hey, what we need is to find a sweet spot where we have more distributed meat processing that has shorter supply chains on the supply side and the demand side. So imagine slaughterhouses that are placed between the ranchers and major markets. And one of the things that you said that tells me your intuition is really good, Rob, indeed the energy systems associated with such a thing, because these are pretty heavy consumers of energy for the freezing, for the delivering cold, to keep the animal products fresh, turn out to be a key part of it. A typical slaughterhouse in a mid-size might spend just under $1 million a year in utility costs, but they've got all this waste product from the animals that could be used to generate some of the energy that could bring that cost down. And so we've actually, I'm a part of a team that's made a pitch to a challenge called Climate Quest at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our team leader is a guy by the name of Bartlett Durand, who's a butcher in Wisconsin. And we're working to try to basically come up with a concept that would totally re-engineer how grass-fed meat is brought to market, so that more consumers could get healthy food. And there's compelling business in this as well. I guess in my view, if we're successful, we would be to coffee what Starbucks was, or maybe the better analogy is in an age where big agriculture is dominated by large institutions, kind of like the automotive industry is, we would be the Tesla Motors to a General Motors, to someone to come in and demonstrate a totally new concept for how we develop and deliver a product that makes business sense and delivers a compelling product to people who are eager to buy that product. So that's one of several business models that we've developed. And my hope would be that once people realize the potential in this space, that not only would it attract ranchers, but entrepreneurs. I met a clever team from Stanford this summer, two young ladies. They're developing an iPad app to help ranchers apply these methods better on their land. I think there's all kinds of businesses that could come out of this space, once kind of the light bulb goes off here. So
right. I've had an idea for some sort of a hedge fund around this too, where we can aggregate these now, several million people playing around with this ancestral health approach, and get a couple of shekels out of each one of those folks, and then leverage that to be able to back some of these entrepreneurial endeavors and see them play out and then provide a great dividend for the people investing in that.
And yeah. Rob, everyone knows that shekels are the most sustainable type of money reference you can make.
Exactly. I kind of use that on purpose. So.
I agree. Crowdfunding has got potential. You know, even though I've talked here about the science of soil carbon, my deepest expertise, frankly, is innovation management strategy. That's what I've done for the last 15 years. And what I'm trying to do with my next 30-year career is figure out how to apply these entrepreneurial techniques to make things happen. And I think that there's a big meta shift underway where, you know, big game-changing things that used to have to come from governments can now happen with startup companies. You know, SpaceX seems really big now, but, you know, I just think it's a huge, huge thing, right, that a little startup company from California could do what only NASA could do just a short time ago. And it started with PayPal, right? So yeah. I think entrepreneurship is going to be real key to unlocking a lot of these things. And there's probably some things. I know, Rob, you're big on ag policy. There's certainly probably some barriers in that. But I don't think there's any reason we have to stop and wait. I think if we unleash entrepreneurs and we connect the demand of people seeking healthy, sustainable food to those entrepreneurs – I think that's the way to get this thing going. And of course, as you mentioned, at the real coalface, the practitioner side, the Savory Institute's doing great work with the Savory Hub. So just letting ranchers teach each other on what works on their land. And that's really, really important.
Yeah, I'm on the board of directors of the Northern Nevada, Northern California Savory Hub, and it's some good friends of ours that Abby and Spencer Smith, and they're just 35, 40 minutes away and really doing some amazing work out in northeast of Reno, Nevada. And this area, interestingly, it was once a vibrant grassland and it is a blasted desert now with almost penultimate end stage that Alan Savory talks about when you've denuded the earth of these perennial grasses. Like we have sage and gravel, and that's about it. And it's pretty interesting. And, you know, a thought along that line, and this is maybe getting really out in left field, but why not goats and camels and all this stuff that used to be part of this native flora and fauna, you know, before humans, the Clovis peoples made it through this area. There were mastodon and bison and all kinds of things around here. I think there were a couple of different types of like elephants. There were goats. There were, you know, camels that were indigenous to this particular area. Should we be looking at trying to, play to that side too? And I know that that's a whole other thing when we're talking about the economics of this, like goat meat consumption is on the rise in the United States because largely of an increasing Hispanic population. So there's a real opportunity there. But, camel seems amazingly well suited to this area when you talk about limited water sources. But how do we get folks fired up about camel meat? You know, what do you guys think about that?
Well, who knows? It takes, an entrepreneur that says, hey, I'm going to create a market for camel meat to do that. To answer your question, though, functionally, is that biodiversity is absolutely key to this. And it's not even just the large animals. One of the members of our science team is a bug guy, right? So studying the role of grasshoppers and insects in this system. And one of the things that's absolutely true is that healthy ecosystems require participation by plant and animal species of all different sizes. It's, you know, the plants, like you said, it's the leguminous plants that are the nitrogen fixers that have to coexist with the grasses for the system to work effectively. And there's got to be flowers in there for the pollinators to work. And so all this stuff connects. But in terms of the herbivores, the more of them and the more diversity of them, the better. Patagonia should get a really big pat on the back. They've been a pioneer in the commercial space here. They've signed contracts for supply of wool production from people who apply these techniques, precisely these techniques, to sheep grazing for wool production. Richard Teague of our team has been active in consulting with the people that work those ranches, and that's been the Savory Hub has been instrumental in shaping those activities. So sheep, goats, who knows, camel, mass. we had a funny conversation about the role of the large animals like mastodon, I guess about a year ago, Peter, huh, when we were at a little retreat, because you know, some of the comments from our people who are more ecologically insightful than myself is that there really was an important interplay between grasslands and forests, and those large animals actually had a role to play in terms of managing that interface. In other words, when elephants are in there, they'll knock down trees, right? They're kind of an alternative to fire in managing how trees and grasslands work together. So I don't think we know a lot about, you know, exactly what the recipe is. We kind of know directionally where to go in this stuff, but yeah, the more diversity, the better. And I think in a lot of ways, what we're trying to do with cattle here is it's a very doable, very scalable way to replicate what the bison used to do in North America, at least.
Right.
You know, probably take us a little while longer to kind of get the bison system. And of course, that brings all kinds of other challenges in place as well. I have a bison producer here 5 miles north of my house who started to graze bison. And I'm telling you, it's awesome. You know, it's better than any bison I've gotten from other supply chain. So I hope that people bring back species diversity. And I just got to believe that that'll have an impact on human health as well. I think eating the same, it's not just nose to tail. It's, I think, diversity of protein sources is probably going to have positive human health impacts as well. So again, the system is coupled when we think about it, right?
Right. And
we're
maybe,
talking.
Go ahead, please.
Thanks, man. We're talking about system. Yeah, Rob, you mentioned systems. Russ, you're just talking about systems, and that's really when I was making Soil Carbon Cowboys, I had a lot of questions. You know, is carbon being sequestered? If so, is it the kind of carbon that stays in the soil for a long time, like decades or centuries, or is it the kind that just cycles back up through the plant life, and that's fine too? What about methane? Everyone talks about methane in cattle. So what's going on with the methane on these systems, or the nitrous oxide? And Russ mentioned bugs. You know, what's happening with the bugs above and below ground? What's going on there? What's happening with the mycorrhizal fungi, and what's happening with the bacteria to fungi ratio? And what's happening with the animal well-being and the animal health and the health of the meat of the animal and the rancher well-being and the rancher's health, and what's happening with forage production, and what's happening with wildlife, from insects to birds to large animals. And as I was asking these questions, I got to meet a lot of scientists around the country. A lot of them were just talking on the phone, and every single one of them was a specialist in one of the things I just mentioned. And they were really excited to measure these things on these ranches, but they all were marginalized. All of them were hamstrung from doing the work they wanted to do. And so we at Arizona State, where I teach, we just said, come on out and let's see if this is a team. And 10 scientists came out, and we realized that there was a team of like-minded people who wanted to try and study these systems, these whole systems where carbon is the currency. And so now that was a grant from the Walton Foundation. We just got a grant from the Thornburg Foundation to bring the science team back together again, and we're ready. We have our game plan, we have our budget, we have our methods, we have our team, and we're going to measure anywhere between 36 and 81 ranches around the U.S., high stock continuous grazing, low stock continuous grazing being the way it's been done for about 150 years, just letting the animals roam from fence to fence, and maybe you have paddocks that are the third of the size of your ranch, to this high stock density, short rotational grazing, adaptive grazing technique that we've been talking about this conversation. Let's just see what's the difference. Let's measure it, and let's take a snapshot. And that's really exciting, because we're looking at the whole system at large scale. And it just – I can't believe it hasn't been done before, but it hasn't. I mean, if there's a listener today who knows about this being done, let us know. But we've been looking, and we know the USDA is really interested in this. We know a lot of companies that want to create businesses out of these ranching operations are very interested in this. We know a lot of environmental groups are very interested in this. We know a lot of companies are very interested in this. And so now we're going to ask all of those people to put their money where their mouth is, or put their money where their interest is, and help us fund this large, exciting science project that's going to touch all the stuff we've been talking about.
Awesome.
Yeah, and in looking at this stuff, one of the key things we'll really be looking at is getting away from that anecdotal stuff where the data we have is simply because someone was there and measured it. Or we've kind of mapped out basic different ecosystems and environments around North America and said, if we go out and get these ranches and we can compare these people with different practices in the Southeast, in the Midwest, in the far North, in the arid West, in California, in Texas, you know, we can start understanding what are the controlling variables here. Certainly things like rainfall are going to be important, seasonal average temperature, sunlight. You know, we'll probably learn a whole bunch of stuff that we didn't know to even ask the question before by doing this project. So we've, you know, like Peter said, we've just assembled this team. We're kind of dotting our I's and crossing our T's on the actual project plan now. And hopefully we think it's something we can do over about a 3-year period to get some real high quality research to go out and do this. So maybe shorter if things go well. But anyhow, this is probably in the evolutionary health perspective, you guys probably went through this phase 10 years ago or so. And we're just kind of entering it now in the soil health dimension.
Yeah, you know, it was maybe about 8-10 years ago that we got the very first kind of human clinical trials looking at a paleo diet versus like a Mediterranean diet or a standard American diet and stuff like that. And it's only been later that we've been looking at these interventions for specific disease processes. So it's interesting. It's tracking very similarly.
Yeah, and I think they'll be coupled. You know, I know you also a fan of Martin Blaser and the missing microbes thing, right? Where the whole idea is that there's a coevolution between the micro species and the macro species. And it's the same thing here. So I think that the things that you continue to learn in the evolutionary health perspective will help us formulate good questions for research here as well. And not the least of which is nutrition, for what it's worth. I think one of the, something I haven't found any research on yet, and if it exists, I'd love to hear about it. The best research that I think that's been aggregated so far is by Cindy Daly right there in Chico, who I believe you might know, Cindy.
Yeah.
Who did the best work in terms of documenting the nutritional differences between grain-fed beef and grass-fed beef. But no one, to the best of my knowledge yet, has looked at the nutritional differences between grass-fed beef that's been raised in this holistic practice versus other normal grass-fed beef, or maybe the cattle are just grazed normally on open pastures. Because if we're right, there's an implicit thing in here where we should be cycling the nutrients from the soil better,
right?
That we're getting the, you know, right micronutrients in the food that allow maximum growth and et cetera. And we don't know that, but we think that's an interesting question. So there may be some coupling that occurs directly on that dimension of this project. We'll see.
Lauren Cordain did a interesting analysis, a whole body rendering of some wild deer and elk, and looking at the specifically just the fatty acid profile in those critters, and it was markedly different than just a monoculture grass-fed cow. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, that's all speculative. We don't have any data to hang our hats on, but it was markedly different, and that was just looking at the fatty acids. It's not looking at all these there's tens of thousands of carotenoids and other fat-soluble phytonutrients that get associated with the fat in these animals and in our own bodies that seem to have influence on the way that our biome actually processes them. People talk a lot about polyphenolics and different plant products that are beneficial for health, but it's typically our gut bacteria that process those, and then it's the product of that processing that we end up benefiting from. So that's a huge, huge story, and we have zero information on it.
And zero information, but I think it was your friend Chris Masterjohn that turned me on to the micronutrient benefits of grass-fed meat. You know, that those fatty fat-soluble vitamins are the things that make grass-fed beef fat a little bit yellow,
right?
And so the idea that yellow fat is good fat is kind of contrarian. Most current markets look at fat and say, hey, you want it to be white because it looks pretty.
So let's bleach it. Yeah.
So let's bleach it, right? And I think, you know, one of the marketing things here is going to help people appreciate, no, when you see yellow fat, that means it's going to be rich in micronutrients. And I only just this summer finally got around to reading Weston Price's, big magnum opus on that stuff. And I think there's even interesting dimensions here. You know, you might recall, documented how dairy products varied seasonally by geography. And he used to have samples of butterfat sent in from 16 different regions around North America and showed how the fat-soluble vitamin content would vary according to the time of year based on what the animal was grazing at the time. And I think that it's very plausible we're going to see the same type of thing emerge in the meat products as well.
Well, Russ,
if we go look at
Gary Zimmer's cheese.
Yeah, we met a dairy farmer in Wisconsin here a couple months ago. Gary Zimmer, really brilliant soil scientist himself. He applies very similar principles, let's say, in soil nutrients. And we had his cheese. It was just mind-blowing.
It's seasonal. He's got winter cheese, spring cheese, summer cheese, fall cheese, and you can taste the difference. It's the same animals on the same lands,
wow.
Just different plants growing. It's
right.
One's really tangy, one's really smooth. It was amazing.
Right. And no, he hasn't gone in and actually measured kind of what's the fat and vitamin differences between them, but I'll bet they're significant.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's probably what's driving the taste differences. So I think there's just a zillion areas for research in this stuff. And I think one of the things, you know, back to the original realization here, we'll know we're on the right course when we start finding solutions that what's good for the planet is good for our health, is also good for local economies. I think this is what really got me hooked here when Peter first called me. I'm like, holy cow, you know, usually because my career for the last 15 years has been investing in people with very novel energy technology ideas. That's my wheelhouse. And here's an idea that's related to energy in the form of carbon sequestration and ultimately, potentially, as you said, in terms of distribution, energy consumption and distributed production systems. But it's this pathway here that it all connects into something where everybody wins, right? You just don't see that very often. And I think it's because we're, you know, going back into this evolutionary framework of where things have co-evolved. And so once you figure out how they all fit together, when the system is working right, all the components of the system get better, as opposed to one has to suffer in order for something else to succeed.
This gets really far afield, but there's this whole concept of the Nash equilibrium in game theory. And, you know, if you've got a complex system and the players in that system follow a pre-prescribed set of rules, then all of the individuals end up maximally benefiting. But when one individual breaks that rule, and I would argue that humans maybe through ingenious, but perhaps we're going to find out maybe a misguided application of technology, we've broken a lot of the rules that underpin ecology, then that Nash equilibrium has been broken. And although we've had a short-term benefit, we could argue with regards to economies of scale from an intensification of food production and whatnot, in the long run, that system will eventually break. And that's kind of the foundation of this whole Nash equilibrium, which is going to be a chunk of my talk at PaleoFX talking about that stuff. But when you talk about that, it just makes me very excited because, it has a little bit of that feeling of that fractal element that it should be good for local economies, should be good for the environment, should be good for humans, and it should be, you know, again, mutually beneficial on all scales, and then we're following within that Nash equilibrium.
And for the animal well-being, too. Again, back to my vegan and vegetarian friends, part of the reason they're so against eating meat is the industrialization of the meat. And if they felt like the animals were being treated well, then they back away from saying no one should eat meat. We were at a restaurant in Chicago where this woman said, wherever we go on this research we've been doing, we find the grass finished beef places. And this one woman said, yeah, they have a great life, just one bad day.
and which, you know, is pretty much everybody's story.
I was going to say, there you go. That fits everyone.
Rob, I really look forward to seeing what you do at PaleoFX, because I think this insight about that humans as the single agent broke nature's Nash equilibrium is bang on. I think that's a really, really good insight. You know, we used to, like I said, I've been in the innovation business for quite a while. And for a long time, the last 10 years, there's been this big trend of biomimicry, which is, how do we imitate nature? How do we replicate features that we see in nature in order to invent new widgets and processes that, that allow us to be more efficient? But I think what this stuff does is what I'll call biomimicry 2.0, which is, how do we actually tap into and work with nature instead of just sit on top of it and try to imitate it? I think that once we realize that humans are a participant in nature, not something that rides on top of it, I think it'll open up all kinds of opportunities here where you can kind of eat your cake and have it too. But you got to think systemically.
Natural technology, right, Russ?
What's that?
Natural technology.
Natural technology. That's right. This is all about natural technology.
And Rob.
Can
I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Because I'm the guy who's usually asking the questions, right? What have you read? I think it's David Montgomery's book called Dirt.
I have. Yes. Yeah.
Because I just think about that book, and again, it's not like, you know, we started making mistakes 150 years ago or 250 years ago. As soon as we started digging the soil with any kind of implement 10,000 years ago, we started cutting through the mycorrhizal fungi. And it's sort of been very few people getting it right and a lot of people mucking it up since then, right?
Yeah, and Jared Diamond in his book Collapse talked about that, and he ended up covering a lot of the same material. Not everybody has... Typically, the story is that people end up screwing it up in a pretty epic fashion, but occasionally folks figure out some sort of a legitimately long-term sustainable way to make both their economies and their food production work. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and what I thought in that Dirt book that Peter mentioned and in Collapse, it's basically civilizations are successful because they temporarily exploit the soil. And then when it doesn't work anymore, you know, they pick up and move somewhere else, or they just die away. And I think the opportunity here now is, once we understand this system, it's not even about compromise anymore. It's about synergy. It's like, you know, humans and soil, once they're back in phase in this Nash, if we reestablish the Nash equilibrium, the bugs win and we win. In fact, this is one of those... you know, I don't think you can read some of those books on microbiome stuff without coming up with questions about, you know, who's controlling the show here, right? Are we providing basically? We're just a symbiotic host for the microbes to be able to exist in. And I think you come to a similar thing here with the soil stuff. In a lot of ways, the soil microorganisms here have evolved an ecosystem to feed it energy. And if we figure out how to do that well, they'll treat us well. At the same time, and if not, well, you know, as long as there's another place to move on to, we're good. I thought, Rob, have you seen this new movie Interstellar yet?
I have not yet.
Awesome.
People have been telling me to go see it, but I have not yet.
Yeah. So the underlying plot, right, is that, you know, we've screwed up the soil on planet Earth, and so now we need to go find a new planet. It won't give anything away. But I think what we're talking about here is, what we have in front of us is an opportunity to figure out how to make planet Earth work. Yeah, right. So we don't have to go to the faraway galaxy to find a new home.
No,
I like that. I like that, Rob. Find a new planet. That's really good.
Yeah, yeah.
This one.
Yeah, the one we got.
Well, it's like when you have guests and you live in a big city and you have guests visit. All of a sudden, you see things in your city you never would go to when you're just living there. You know, maybe we need to look at Earth as from the tourist's point of view.
Right. Well, because we kind of are. And, you know, just to, man, I could seriously drive this thing for like 3 hours if you guys were willing to do it. But to kind of circle back to one of the first things that Russ mentioned when we cracked this thing open, the number of people that once were involved with farming and food production and how small a number that is now. It's interesting from kind of a economics perspective, where manufacturing has been outsourced, and there's all kinds of, you know, different efficiencies that seem to be going into manufacturing, whereas this holistic management of food production, I mean, maybe we'll someday have a smart enough robot to pull a lot of that stuff off, but it seems like that's maybe another century down the road or something like that. But it seems like there's a huge opportunity for a lot of folks that, you know, are popping out of college. They don't know what they're going to do. They're not really satisfied with the current system. And maybe we need to start educating people about how to be farmers, and then we aggregate some money and buy vast tracts of land and do some experimentation on all this. And we both are propping up our economic side by getting people, you know, into career paths that could, you know, be multi-generational type approaches. But it's
Absolutely.
Also patching up the soil and solving a lot of other problems, because the historical manufacturing base of the United States is just gone. And, you know, there's all kinds of wistful talking about bringing that back. And I think that that's a pipe dream. But if we were to reallocate a lot of resources and skull sweat into producing healthy food in a healthy environment, then everybody seems to win out of that.
I think one of the aha moments for me in this whole, you know, last 2 years of really working at this and thinking about it and meeting so many smart people is that we truly could be looking at a way to create a vibrant agrarian middle class. And again, everyone wins. And just one little thing about that, I was just at the Tomcat Ranch out in California, and there's this guy there. He graduated from Stanford, and he's working on a ranch. And it's not like he's working on a ranch for a summer to then go back and get his finance job. He's working on a ranch because his career is going to be in the soil. And he's happy about it. And his parents are happy about it. And his advisors at Stanford are happy about it. And that right there is what you're talking about in three dimensions.
Yeah. It's Stanford of all places, right? You know, this I grew up in Nebraska and went to school in Iowa. And so you expect it out of there. I you know, it's still a really small movement, Rob, and you probably see some from your side too, but I know you know Chris Kirsten at the Sabre Institute, right? But there's a budding community of practitioners here that are kind of, they're entrepreneurs. They're heading out to reinvent agriculture, and it's just inspiring to meet with them and again to offer insights and anything we can to help them. So really exciting stuff going on there. And I do hope that we can kind of recreate the middle class. And by the way, I don't, the only thing where maybe my perspective is slightly different here is I want to be cautious not to paint this as some sort of return to the old ways holistically. I think of this as, if we get it right, it's kind of like a positively ever expanding spiral where history, you know, the current reality rhymes with history, but isn't the same. I think there's plenty of room for technology to enable this kind of stuff to happen well, but it's got to be thought of in a different context, right? So, things like, you know, we mentioned missing microbes, right? You know, antibiotics, very effective, saved billions of people, brought health to the masses, and now we start to recognize some unintended consequences. But you know, there'll be plenty of opportunities for different ways of dealing with infectious disease that are more sustainable. And I think the same thing will be true here as well. So big data, IT systems for ranch management, water management, soil carbon. We're working with Peter just had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with guys at NASA JPL on measuring things from satellite.
Mm-hmm.
And so this isn't a kind of a tech-averse world. It's not like give up the opportunity to do some interesting kind of forward technology stuff. Let's use that technological innovation and insight inside of a sustainable paradigm, let's say, on how to grow food in our economy in a way where everybody wins. And by the way, I think it's also going to couple... I may have mentioned in my introduction, I think that our food systems, our energy systems, and our water systems all get reconnected again once we figure this stuff out. And so that's the scope of space where entrepreneurs are being able to enter and make some big stuff happen. So,
Awesome. Well, I've got to tell you guys, this is the most exciting element of this whole ancestral health story is actually the food production side and all, you know, everything that's happening with this. And I keep telling people that when I feel like I've cracked the nut on this healthcare side of things, I'm going to disappear like a thief in the night, and I'll be out on a farm somewhere, being completely incapable at first, but figuring out how to do this stuff for myself and my family. Like that's the next step for me, is actually getting in and becoming part of this food production scene, not just talking about it. And you know what? It's interesting. When I first stumbled onto this paleo diet concept, there were maybe 200 people in the world that would have known what the heck it was. And now, you know, it's millions of people doing it. It's been on an exponential growth trend on Google searches since around 2006. And it seems like we're just at the front wave of this. So it's really exciting to see this next phase where there may be relatively few people today involved in this holistic management of food production. But what's really cool is that there is a built-in market of this ancestral health scene that is just waiting for folks to scale this and run with it. So I am hoping that the runway is much shorter and the climb is much faster for this food production story than what it was even for this health and medicine story.
Us too.
Amen.
Awesome. Well, Peter, Russ, thank you guys so much for being on the show. Anything that I can do, that this bigger community can do to support you guys, I absolutely here for you. If you ever want to undertake some crowdfunding type activities, glad to help with that. Any projects that you're working on, always glad to get the message out. So
thank you.
Carte blanche. Anything you want, we'll do it. Yeah.
Thank
Other than
so
me
much,
dancing though. Or singing, that would be cool. So.
Well, we might want that too.
there's a genre for everything, apparently. So, well, guys, thank you so much, and look forward to seeing what you have going in the future.
Thank you, Rob.
Great.
All right, guys. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Take care.
All right, bye.